I have been reading in the Bible and in the Book of Mormon and in some other books as well, some books of poetry and thoughts and expressions written by many. And I'd like to bring some of these ideas to you today. Might be that they'd be more appropriate, better planned if we were sitting on a hillside somewhere in the grass and surrounded by the beauties of nature and just quietly discussing our philosophy of life than it would be to say that this is a sermon. But nevertheless, it's 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, so here we are. You'll have to imagine the grass and the clouds and the sky, and as we discuss and think and meditate about these things. I was reading in the 12th chapter of the Book of Alma about a man who wanted to do the work of the Lord. He had that purpose in his mind, and he didn't know how he was going to do it, but he just picked himself up with his zeal and enthusiasm and took off, so to speak. And kind of reminded me, you know, of a poem that I had been reading, and I read this poem, and the gist of it was that, Lord, I'd like to go out into the fields and the flowers and relax and recuperate my powers and draw closer to you. But the Lord said, get into the town. Well, I don't see any reason, Lord, why I should go to the town. It's full of noise and pollution and all manner of distractions, and I want to go out into the fields where I can be motivated and inspired and my spirit can be lifted and soared. But the Lord said, get in the town. That's where the sinners live. That's where the work is to be done. And this man, Ammon, was kind of like that. He wanted to do the work of the Lord. He wanted to save the souls of men and women. And he didn't really know where to go or where to turn or how to start. So he picked himself up and he took off into the forest, looking for whatever might befall him. And sure enough, he found himself right in the middle of it, as so often we do when we take ourselves out of our little ivory castles and out of the fields and the flowers and the places where we draw our inspiration and recuperate our own resources and get out into the world. He found himself right in the middle of it. And as a result, he found himself eventually, as a result of his taking a hand in some of the activities that engulfed him, he found himself standing before the king of these very people that he'd been interested in. And Ammon asked the king this question. He said, believest thou that there is a God? The king says, I don't know. I don't even know what you're talking about. So Ammon began right then and there to rehearse, I think the Book of Mormon says, to rehearse, to talk about, to tell the marvelous story of the Creator and the plan of redemption for the children of men. And the king and his people believed. But I thought, you know, how vitally important it might be for you, some of you, maybe not all, but how vitally important it might be for some of you to be able to just pick yourself up sometime and get out of the midst of all our friends and those who support us and uphold us and find ourselves in unfriendly situations, confronted with the responsibility of carrying the story of the gospel, and without script or purse, without something to read, be able to convey your philosophy of life. Be able to convey to those about you in any circumstance and in every circumstance how one with God can meet and resolve life problems. I think also that there may come times in every person's life when they need to take time to just sit down and ask themselves the question, what do I really believe? There may come a time in any person's life, and I think there shall, when they are so beset by conflicting ideas, so beset by conflict, by doubt, by indecision, by not knowing what is the right thing to do, by failure, by attempting to do things and seeing that they don't work out the way we thought. There comes a time when perhaps everybody needs to sit down and decide and know so that they can live from that moment on a definite, what is it that I really believe and how should it affect my life? Now, this morning, I'd like to tell you some things I really believe. Now, I'm not going to tell you what you need to do. That's preaching. I'm not going to tell you what the Lord wants you to be doing. But I'd like to share with you some things I really believe. If perchance, someday, off in the future, a man from the earth, maybe from America, maybe from Russia, a man from earth should be the first to land his spaceship on the surface of the planet Mars and be the first earth being to ever walk that planet and discover what had happened there, he would have his eyes wide open. He'd be looking for everything that he could find that would give him clues as to the characteristics of and the past of the history of this strange and marvelous planet called Mars that's kind of stimulated the thoughts of men for centuries and centuries. And he might find about him all manner of clues and evidence that would lead him then to be able to make up his mind about many things. He might pick up there on the land of Mars, he might pick up a specimen that looks like this. What would he know about Mars? He'd know, well, there's kind of pink and gray material up there on Mars. You know, that's not very much to know. Shaped like a little triangle there. That's not very much to know. If he turned it over and looked at the other side and he saw definite crystals here, he would know that there's been some kind of volcanic igneous activity on Mars sometime in its past. And as that rock cooled, crystals were formed. He would then know something quite important about it. As he continued to walk about the surface of that strange new planet, he might find a rock that looked like this. What would he know about it then, Dave? Dave's squinting his eyes to see that rock. It's kind of small. What would he know about it then? He'd know sometime or other in the past there were plants that lived here on this Mars because we see the imprint of their leaves here in this rock. And he's learned a great deal about this planet that now we can only guess at. He was walking along, Barry, and he found that. What would he know about Mars? Look at that. All I do is pick up a rock and show Barry, and he says he'd know there were human beings on Mars. How does Barry know? How does Barry... What grade are you in, Barry? How does this sixth grader know just by looking at a rock that there were human beings on Mars if he should find this rock there? You know, the answer is so obvious. It amazes me why so many, countless millions of people don't know it. He looks at that rock and he knows it was no accident. He knows it just didn't happen. Because when he looks at that rock, he sees creative thought and power behind it. It was fashioned first in an intelligent mind, and then with talent, it was shaped. It has design. It has plan. It has order. When I look at the universe, when I look at all of nature that surrounds us, I see behind it intelligent plan and design and order. And I know, just like Barry knew, that there was behind, before this universe existed, there was God. By whatever name men might want to call him, there was God. His hand has shaped and designed and planned and set into motion all that we see about us. And all one has to do is look at the mysteries and the marvels of nature, and we can see this intelligence. And it isn't just like a great big machine, you know, all the planets wheeling in their orders and the stars and the galaxies. One astronomer said it best when he said, "To me, the universe seems more like a gigantic thought." And we can see it there behind and in everything that's around us, this creative force. And hence, in my life, I'm going to seek order and plan and design and preparation. I'm going to endeavor to avoid confusion, to avoid being unprepared, to avoid not having a plan. Because plan and order and design are the attributes of God. And I, and probably you, wish to follow them and employ them. When I look at all of nature, I see this. It was Job who said the same sort of thing thousands of years ago. He said, "Ask now the beasts, and they shall teach thee, and the fowls of the air, and they shall tell thee. Or speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee. And the fishes of the sea shall declare unto thee. Because who knoweth not that in all these things the hand of the Lord hath wrought this and manifest itself to the children of men?" And from time to time, in spite of the poem, I'm going to endeavor to get out of the town and commune with nature and rebuild my fundamental faith and beliefs in God Almighty, and learn the lessons that she has to teach, and look and listen and endeavor to understand him better who set into motion all these beautiful, marvelous things that we see. Yes, I see in nature a bright design. We could talk for hours and hours and hours about how nature bespeaks God and his love and concern and care for all of his creation. But you know, really, that's the most elemental. That's the most basic of all these things that we believe, in a God who has set this bright design in all his creation. Because we believe as well that there's a greater plan than that. There's a greater plan than the one which takes the salmon back to the very river that they began their life, to again begin a new generation of these marvelous creatures of God. There's a greater plan than the physical plan we see manifested in the world about us. Because we believe in a plan as well that encompasses mankind. We believe that God has set into motion a plan that governs and controls and affects the destiny of nations and the history of men and women. We believe that God has shown us his redemptive power and plan for mankind through Jesus Christ. And that he is revealed through revelation, through the scripture, other parts of his plan to the children of men. And their plans that involve your well-being, that involve your children, that involve your very life and existence, that involve you today and tomorrow in the future, that should help you decide how to vote in the election in November. They are that definite, and they are that vital and important. And I believe in the plans that God has for the children of men, and that I need to understand it, and that again, I and perhaps all of us need to, I guess the word is, be prepared for what God has planned. We need to understand and see and be aware of and be prepared for what God has planned and, more importantly, revealed to us. But as I think of God and his plan for the children of men and all creation, I believe also in worship. I believe in the essential necessity for men and women to worship this Lord who has created us, who has loved us and guided us, and guides our ways just as he does the birds of the air and the fish of the sea. I believe that it is our responsibility and opportunity to worship him. And so we come here today, complying with a commandment that's been given to the children of men. You know, even before the days of Christ, men were commanded to take time out from the work and the pleasures and the activities of this world and to worship God. And we can find here this commandment as it's recorded in the book of Mosiah in chapter 9. And there was one day in every week that was set apart that they should gather themselves together to teach the people and to worship the Lord their God, and also as often as was in their power to assemble themselves together. Yes, I believe in the necessity to worship God. The only question might come in when we ask the question, you know, how? How can we best do it? I have a little book at home. It's called The Art of Living. Many of you are familiar with it. It has a lot of beautiful things in it. It has a chapter called The Art of Awareness, The Art of Thanksgiving, The Art of Giving. And the whole thing is there about life, you know. One chapter that should be there and is not. The Art of Worship. Because we believe, you and I, that worship of the Lord is good and essential. How do we do it? Psalmist David tells us something about it. I'd like to read six verses from the 105th and the 104th Psalm. Here's what he says. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Sing unto him. Sing psalms unto him. Talk ye of all his wondrous works. Glory ye in his holy name. Let the heart of them rejoice who seek the Lord. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his face forevermore. Remember his marvelous works that he hath done, his wonders and the judgments of his mouth. Bless thou the Lord, O my soul. Praise ye the Lord. What's the psalmist talking about? He's talking about our worship, is he not? He's talking about how we worship. As we listen to all those things he says there, there's no limit. There's no limit to the ways by which and in which and through which we can worship the Lord. There's no limit to where it has to take place. There's no limit into what form it might be. We can do it in so many ways, and we endeavor to do it. We endeavor to do it by coming to hear the word of the Lord and grow in our understanding and our knowledge of Him because we love Him and because we feel the importance of being where He perhaps may be closer to us. We feel the importance of growing in our understanding. We don't come together here because we feel better than all the people that aren't here with us. We don't come together here. This really is a collection of people who feel the need of God, feel the need to draw closer to Him, to understand Him more completely. And so we gather ourselves together, and we call it a preaching service. John likes to call it a worship service. It doesn't make any difference what name we call it. It's to hear about and learn about our Heavenly Father. We come together from time to time to have a prayer service because prayer is a way of worship. We come together here to have a song service. We meet together in our homes to talk about Him. We come together to sing praises to His name. We come together to study. All these things are good. They involve our love and respect and dependence upon the Lord and our desire to draw closer to Him. We call that worship. But you know, in the 15th chapter of St. Matthew, Christ said something to a bunch of people that went to church every Saturday on the Sabbath day. In verses 8 and 9 of chapter 15, He says, "This people draweth near unto me with their mouth, and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they do worship me." He goes on to say, "teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." But the little text that kind of sticks there in my mind is, "In vain do they worship me." We can worship the Lord if by worship we mean come to preaching services, come to study classes, come to gospel meetings, come to song services, come to prayer meetings. We perhaps could worship the Lord in vain. And in the 4th chapter, St. John, Christ tells an individual there, because you see, God is a spirit, and those that worship Him must worship Him in truth and in spirit. Which takes me then to this belief that worship of God is a matter of individual importance, not collective. It's a matter of personal importance to me, not necessarily collective. There have been those individuals in the past who worship God when surrounded by heathen multitudes clamoring for their death. There have been those who worship God as they were being beset upon by lions that sought to kill them. There were those who worshiped God in alien lands. There were those who worshiped God when thrown out of their temples and their churches and their synagogues. And there are those who worship God in spirit and in truth here in His house. But the point is, the worship has to be in here. It isn't something that is dependent upon another. And so often have I been prone, and others too, so often have I been prone to come to the house of the Lord to worship Him and let external circumstances detract from my worship. Let the relationship of other people detract from my worship and make it impossible for me to draw as close to God as I need to be. Worship, my worship, I believe, is a thing of personal, internal importance that really nobody can do anything about but me. I do believe there are things that will help us in our worship. And so I must make my life and my pattern of living and reacting fit these things that I believe. For example, I believe that God is not the author of confusion. Therefore, when I come to worship Him, I believe that His house should not be a scene of confusion. And all I have to do is say that, and right away, around the room and in the congregation, there are all kinds of people reacting inside, you know, to the thought. When I say the Lord's house should not be a place of confusion, some people say, yep, that's right. And some people are saying, I know what he's getting at, and that's all wrong, you know. But really, nobody knows what I'm getting at just yet. What I'm getting at is what I believe, that's all. I believe that God's house, when we come to God's house, it should be because of our love for Him. And when we come here, we should show a kind of reverence to Him and before Him. A kind of reverence. The same kind of awe that perhaps we feel when we stand at the brink of the Grand Canyon. The same kind of wonder, perhaps, that we feel when we stand there on the edge of Yellowstone Falls and see all those tons of water cascading down that beautiful canyon. The same kind of quiet reverence we feel and exhibit, perhaps, when out in an aspen grove we're listening to the sound of a bird singing there in the forest. Trying to drink it in, trying to see and feel and hear it and experience it all. That is what I believe is the way I must worship if I would really draw close to God. It doesn't mean we can't talk to one another in church. No, I don't think it means that. I don't think it means that we can't smile when we see our brothers and sisters come in. I don't think it means that we can't greet one another in the right way and exhibit a friendliness toward one another that we associate with the bonds of the gospel of Christ. I don't believe that it means that we have to sit and look sad. I don't believe that it means we have to come in and kneel in prayer right here throughout. Worship is bigger than that. It has more aspects. It has more sides than that. But I do believe it means that in every way possible, I must show reverence when I'm here. And if I would ask a question of someone that I love and feel close to, or if I would give a greeting, that I'd do it in a way appropriate to this place where I am. You know, we do so many silly things. From the time our kids are this big, we tell them, that's wrong. Don't whisper. Don't whisper. That's naughty, you know. You shouldn't whisper. What fools we are when we teach our children not to whisper. When I'm having a class over there at Loma Linda and two kids are discussing something good and worthwhile, oh, how I wish they'd whisper. How I wish their folks had never taught them they shouldn't whisper. Instead of that, they bellow like a wounded wolf, you know, and it destroys the very good thing that's going on. When we come to church and there is communication that we want to give to one another, oh, how wonderful it'd be if we'd forget the teachings of our mothers and our fathers and learn to whisper. What a marvelous thing. To greet one another with a soft but friendly and sincere word. But we don't have to have a place of distraction. We don't have to have a noise level that would drive a jet pilot out of his skull, you know. We don't have to have that. We come and we worship in reverence. And where does reverence begin and where does it end? Does it start when we walk in those doors? Or does it also include tearing up the shrubbery on the outside of God's house, too? Does it also include throwing litter around all over the churchyard, as well as being reverent on the inside of his house? I mean, where are the limits of God? Does our reverence for God, does it carry over into all parts of our life? Or is it just a place that we set aside for a little 24 by 36 building on Harvard Street that looks pretty nice on the inside and looks like a shambles on the outside most of the time? And those are things that we must decide. What do we really believe about God and about our relationship with Him? I believe we could enhance our worship by reverence to God and by respect to all men, and by establishing beauty and order in our homes and in our lives and at our church, by having the dignity of cleanliness and beauty for everybody to see everywhere that we are, because that's where we want God to be. That's just what I believe. I believe that our worship can be enhanced. And I know that mine must be, it's a personal thing, as I mentioned. And so I know that to really worship God, I must come with that purpose in mind. At 10 minutes of 10, I can't all of a sudden discover for the first time, oh my goodness, it's time for Sunday school to begin, I must hurry. I must have planned and prepared for this day. I must come here this day having set at home at the time of my awakening my plans and purposes as I set about my activities of the day. I must come here with some purpose to draw closer to God, to draw closer to my brothers and sisters, to know and discover His will. I must come here to find some purpose in my life that God has for me. And I know that if I entered those doors like that, there was never a sermon so dull. There was never a sermon so uninspired that I couldn't meet my goals and purposes. If my worship is going to be complete, I'm going to have to open my heart to God. Before I come, while I'm coming, and while I'm here, and after I leave, I've got to center and focus, so to speak, though the word doesn't really seem to apply. I've got to focus my thinking and heart and feeling on Him. On Him. Not on all the activities and problems and cares and pleasures of my everyday life. But I must learn to focus all these things upon God. And then will He be able to shine into my life? And perhaps most important and hardest to do, I'm going to really worship God, I've got to center my attention on God. I've got to center my attention on Him. I can't worship God here, I guess, if I am thinking about the homework assignment that I need to be getting done for tomorrow. I can't really worship God completely the way I need to and want to if my thoughts are wandering about toward the coming weekend and the activities that I might be engaged in there. If they are worrying about the date that I'm going to have next Friday, or what clothes I ought to wear when I go to school tomorrow, or the work that's left undone at home, or all the multitudes of things that we come and think about and talk about and whisper about and write about, when we really told ourselves we were coming here to worship God. To worship means then to do all the things that we do, but do it with the right heart. Do it with full intention and attention to the things at hand. Do it with our minds upon God. And so often I hear people say, you know, got a lot of things to do, so I'm staying home this time because that song service. But brothers and sisters, song service is worship. And it only ceases to be worship when, as I have done, and as Harold has done, and as Gary has done, when we have stood up here during song service, and we look out and see of the congregation six people singing, then it is no longer song service. Because the rest of the people have not centered and are not centering their full attention to the purpose for our having gathered. And if we would but just do that, if we would but just do that, our song service could become a vitally alive form of worship to us, like it was to the psalmist David. Prayer service. Prayer service is worship when we pray. It's worship when we do what David said and speak to one another about the marvelous things that have come into our lives. When we concentrate upon what one another has said. And when a brother back here, feeling a particular need or desire, says, please, let's sing the third verse of this song. When we all sing the third verse of that song, which of you, knowing a brother or sister here in your midst, who asking, please pray for me, I'm going to the hospital tomorrow. Which of you would refuse to do so? No, not one. But how many of you, when a brother or a sister says, please, for some need that I have, let's sing a verse or two of number 272. How many of us sit silently and don't endeavor to meet the need? As I say, this here, see, I go right back to my own problem. My problem is when I come here too often, I let what other people are doing or not doing interfere with my worship. And I'm sorry, and I need to overcome that. But it does. Oh, how it does. Oh, how it interferes with my spiritual well-being when we're having a song service, but nobody's singing. When we're having a prayer service, but nobody's praying. Not even the people that wanted the prayer service. When we're having a testimony meeting, but nobody's got anything to say for the Lord or about Him in their life. It does interfere. I mustn't let it. And I've got to struggle and I've got to fight, but it interferes. And I, and maybe we, are lessened just a little bit. You know, when we allow it to interfere, and when we do those things that do interfere in the worship of our brothers and sisters. But I believe in worship. I believe in its essential necessity in my life. And I don't believe there's anything we do here in this little chapel that couldn't be wonderful, inspiring worship. If we just came with that purpose in mind and joined in and gave our full attention and devotion and participation to it. I'd like to read a poem about something else, I believe. I sought the Lord, and afterward I knew He moved my soul to seek Him. Seeking me. It was not I that found, O Savior true. No, I was found of Thee. Thou didst reach forth Thy hand and mine enfold. I walked and sank not on the storm-vexed sea. 'Twas not so much that I on Thee took hold as thou, dear Lord, on me. I find, I walk, I love, but oh, the whole of love is but my answer, Lord, to thee. For thou wert long beforehand with my soul, and always thou lovest me. I believe that if you could make a mental picture of your brothers and sisters here in this little chapel worshiping with you this day, I believe you would see a most amazing thing, a group of people who didn't choose God, a group of people who didn't choose Jesus Christ, but oh, the wonder of it, a group of people whom God sought out and called and whispered to, and for some mysterious reason had chosen out of the world. You remember what we read in Sunday school this morning? The Lord added daily to the church such as should be saved. Remember the words of Jesus Christ, "You didn't choose me." No, but rather it was I who chose you. That's what Jesus said to his disciples. Do you remember the words when Christ said, "In the end of time, in the last days, for the elect's sake, whom he had called and chosen, he was going to do some marvelous things." You see, the wonder is that we did not choose our Lord, though we think we did, but it was His Spirit striving in the heart of each of us at one time or another who chose us. Look about you then. There should be a most cherished possession. Is there one chosen of God, chosen by Jesus Christ, at whom we would look down our nose? Is there one of whom we would think less than? One of these chosen by God, the wonder of it that He has chosen me, what joy should fill our heart. You know, there isn't a one of us who would be unmoved. You couldn't get them down off the ceiling if they got a letter in the mail and it said, "President Nixon has chosen you, Patsy Ely, to lead a special group of second grade teachers in how to really teach kids," you know. You couldn't pull her down off the ceiling. She'd be walking up there on air. Rowena, President Nixon has picked you out of all the people in the world to head a new department of homemaking and buying and honesty and dealing of department stores with the public. She would swell in her ability, in her willingness to serve. Oh, she'd be filled with humility. Yes, we would. We'd be overawed by the wonder of it. You know, who? Me? Stupid old me, you know? Oh, I can't believe it. But we would expand our mind and our thinking, and we would endeavor to rise to meet the challenge, the wonder of it, that in all this world, God has chosen you. He's put His finger on you, Dorothy and David and Bob and Gary, to do something marvelous and wonderful for Him. It's kind of frightening, and yet what joy and humility and confidence should fill our hearts. What an attitude we should have about these people here. Each and every one of them who like us, for some special thing that God has seen in their life, have been called here today. Look for it, would you please? Instead of looking for all the grubby little human things we do all the time, look at each other. Look for that thing that God has seen in them and in their abilities and in their life that made Him choose them and set them apart and call them out of the world in a special, important period of time to share with you a great and a marvelous undertaking and responsibility. Yes, this I believe, that we have here the seeds of a marvelous group of people living far beneath our station and our dignity because we haven't looked for the heights that are there, the promise that's there. We haven't seen what God has seen. We just see the human frailties and weaknesses in one another. We see ourselves stumble. We see ourselves make mistakes. We see ourselves act human. But God has seen all that too. And in spite of it, He's called you here for some special purpose of His own. And I believe it behooves us then to search for His divine purpose in our own life and maybe a little bit in other people's lives too. To look up at our brother and our sister instead of down. What a responsibility. I'd like to read a scripture from the writings of Paul. Two of them, as a matter of fact, one right after the other. So let me find them both. One's from the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the other one is from the 4th chapter of Ephesians. We read part of it today. We didn't read the part I'd like to read. From the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. Already you know what that chapter is about, don't you? 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians. I'm not going to embarrass anybody by asking you, but you know. I know you know. But that's not what I'm going to read about. I'm not going to read about charity there. I'm going to read about something else. Way down in verse 11. Here's Paul speaking for our benefit. Listen to what he says. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. What's the difference between a child and a man? Now each of you should answer that question. What is, in your thinking, the difference between a child and a man? When we were children, we acted like children. When we were children, we thought like children. We behaved like children. We played like children. But now that we would like to call ourselves a man, now that you like to call yourself a woman, now that you like to call yourself an adult, we must put away the things of childhood. And we must take on something else. What is it? I believe. You believe what you must. I believe. It's a dirty word to some of you. It's responsibility. That's the difference between a child and a man. Now there are those, and I'm not going to knock their argument because it does have some merit in it. But there are those who avoid the word duty and responsibility when associated with the gospel because they think it should always be not responsibility or duty that we feel, but it should be love and desire and on our part. And I can't knock that. It should be. But I'm going right back to what I believe. I believe the difference between a child and his childish way of life and thinking and acting and that of a man is responsibility. The sad part of that story is some children, unlike Paul, never put away their childish toys. Some children are 40 years old. Some children may be 60. But the individual who has never learned to think beyond what I want, to think beyond what pleases me, to think beyond what seems good to me, to think beyond my needs, my pleasure. That individual, whatever their chronological age, is still a child. And when they become a man is when they assume of their own volition duty and responsibility. That's what I believe. That's my philosophy of life. And so I must need to work toward it and apply it into my life. The Apostle Paul talks to all us Christians and he says, I therefore the prisoner of the Lord, even if Wanda doesn't like that expression, I therefore the prisoner of the Lord beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation, the responsibility, the duty to which you have been called. It is to this that God has called us out of the world, to duty, to responsibility. Now, there are many responsibilities in life. And many children, many young people have a real hang-up in the world today. They want to be treated like adults, but they don't want to make the responsible decisions that adults have to make. Many young people and teenagers and people in their 20s and 30s and 40s and 60s and 80s as well want to be treated like mature adults, but they don't want to be responsible for their actions or their inactions. Many people want to be treated and talked to and reacted to like an adult, but they don't want to assume adults' responsibilities. Now, when we're children, it's good to be children, and I love to see children. I love to see them play and be happy. And I feel sorry for people in other parts of the world that have to be adults when they're 15 or 13 or 12 and can't play the game of childhood and youth and teenage irresponsibility that we play in our country, because I think it has merit and it has its place. And yet, responsibility is what it's all about. And the good parent is going to make of his or her child a responsible individual. A good parent is going to teach a children their sense of responsibility toward the rights of other people. In my classroom today, the biggest problem we face is a growing multitude of young people and now of young adults who have no responsibility toward the rights of others. It's still, here's number one, what I want and feel and desire to do. And it includes all kinds of things, from simple little things like littering to the great big things like making the world go. It's responsible people that make the world go around. It's people assuming their responsibilities that make the church grow and expand and be a place of beauty and inspiration, or go the other way around. There are a lot of responsibilities in being a mother, are there not, Louise? And few girls of 17 realize it. And that's why girls of 16 and 17 sometimes make such poor parents, is because they're not prepared for the responsibilities of motherhood. And it's why boys of 16 and 17 and 18 and sometimes of 23 and 25 make such poor providers and husbands and fathers, because they're still selfish little children, not placing their family, their job, their responsibilities of life, their wives before their own desires. But responsible people are the ones that make the world go. There are a lot of responsibilities of being a school teacher. You can't shirk them and be successful. There are a lot of responsibilities of being a good mother You can't shirk them and be successful at raising good, responsible children. There are a lot of responsibilities in being a father. There are a lot of responsibilities in being a minister. There are a lot of responsibilities in being a member of the Church of Christ, and of a little local in particular. If this little local functions, it's because people here shall make it function. If it fails to function, it's because people have failed in meeting their responsibilities. Some are little and almost overlooked. Well, many are purposely overlooked by multitudes. We're having a dinner here today, and it's the responsibility of our good women to help provide for it. If they shirk the responsibility, then we all suffer. We want to come and worship in a place where we can feel reverence. Then it's the responsibility of each family group here to assume the responsibility of being responsible for the well-being and the condition of our little chapel and our annex. So we sign up for it back there every month. And we come out and we clean it and we take care of it. We assume our responsibilities. We want to have music. So it's the responsibility of some to be here to play the piano. We want to have prayer services. So it's the responsibility of us to pray and sing and testify. We want to have a missionary arm in our church. So it's the responsibility of every member of this church to pay their tithing. What they owe God for having called them and saved them out of the perils of the world. This little local has financial responsibilities. They're ours, not the treasurer's, nor the pastor's. They're yours and mine. The man will meet them. The child will grow and grow, and we hope eventually we'll meet them. I believe in responsibility and in duty. And they don't always come easy. I'd like to read a couple little poems. I'm going to read two of them. All I got to do is find them. Here's a poem. I'd like you to listen to it. It's so short and so simple, but it sends the whole message across. I'm only one, but still, I am one. I cannot do everything, but still, I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do. That's responsibility. Some of you can play. Some can sing. Some of you are called to preach. You are called to pray. You can pay tithing. You can do, maybe you can't pay a whole 10%. Maybe right now in your financial circumstances you say, Lord, the very best I can do and still feed my family is just this token. But by doing that token, the day will come that the 10% becomes a possibility, and it can even be increased above and beyond that. That's what it's all about. And I would like to read another poem. We sing a version of this poem all the time. It's what Christian responsibility is all about. I would be true, for there are those who trust me. I would be pure, for there are those who care. I would be strong, for there's much to suffer. And I would be brave, for there's much to dare. I would be a friend of all, foe the friendless. I would be giving, and then forget the gift. I would be humble, for I know my weakness, but I would look up and laugh, love and live.
Thank you.